Hi, this is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. If you're interested in learning about the ketogenic diet like I was, to save my own life, then this is probably the podcast for you. 8 years ago, I knew nothing about it. 6 years ago, it saved my life. 3 years ago, I started researching and talking with some of the authorities in the field and attending medical conferences about this to understand why and how keto so dramatically changed my and my wife's Judy's lives. The purpose of this podcast is to share our journey of discoveries with you and understanding how keto is so effective in improving so many different conditions, from obesity, epilepsy, diabetes, infertility, MS, Alzheimer's, heart disease, to name a few. So take a step away from all the hype you've probably heard and roll up your sleeves with me and join me weekly to explore this living miracle that anyone can access. We'll talk science, we'll talk food. We'll explore its history and evolution to today, which is that the sheer wonder of the ketogenic way of eating has changed untold number of lives, unlike anything before it. And in case I forget to mention it, please join our Facebook group, Keto Naturopath. Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp, and welcome back to the next episode of the Keto Naturopath. Today, I thought you'd find this pretty interesting. You know how technology obviously is getting more and more sophisticated. We can do a lot of things now today that we couldn't do last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Take the glucometer, for instance. So that's the thing that measures your glucose, your blood glucose. Okay, so I think it was about the mid-80s, I'm guessing here, don't quote me on this one, that the meters became a meter that you could, you know, hold and do your own blood, you know, finger prick. And then, you know, and you'd write down the numbers of what those were. And then that became something that, well, you didn't have to write down the numbers. You could contain the numbers in that particular glucometer. It would have a memory. And so then that went to be a little more sophisticated, actually only in the last 5 or 10 years, to the point that you could download that information and you could transmit that information to your doctor's office. So it could be ongoing compiling your data. So by the time you went back for an appointment, he would have your data. Or ideally, if there was some sort of crisis in terms of blood sugar, he would be notified. That's only been very recent. So before the mid-80s, you had to go to a place to get your blood sugar taken. So that's an amazing change. So we're not even talking, we're talking 30 some odd years, 30, 35 years of just that privilege. And now that it's all been somewhat computerized, well, that's pretty neat as well. You get to see your own up and down. You get to see your own variation of your blood sugar. And that's important. So now, along the lines of glucometers, we now come into the era of continuous glucose monitors. So up until 2 years ago, let's say a year ago, to have a continual glucose monitor, which is something you would tape to your body and mostly, and it would go directly into your bloodstream, a capillary, of course, but it would be, in essence, a probe into your bloodstream, and it would be reading your bloodstream live and measuring it. And depending on what you wanted to pay, it could be gaps of, you know, every 5 minutes, every minute, and so on and so forth. So that's how you're paying for that. Well, then Abbott came out with something about a year ago. They started to become popular anyway, in which technically is not a CGM, continual glucose monitor, CGM, but it's a little fiber that goes into your skin. So you click it on and it stays stuck to you for a period of 14 days. You've heard me talk about this before. I just think it's important to sort of map this out because we get numb to the rate of change. We get numb to the rate of invention and that certain aspects of our lives have become more self-aware. I was about to say easier. We know that life is harder for a lot of people, so that technology in one way hasn't helped on that front, but on the blood glucose part, it's become phenomenal. So now we have the Abbott, the CGM. Like, so we're going to call it a CGM just for this conversation, because you can download it. In the course of, you can download it to your laptop, you can look at it in your meter, and anything older, or that I should say newer than an iPhone 6, you can read it on your phone. It will serve as a a meter as well. So all that is pretty neat. So you get to be self-aware. So let me tell you about some of my lessons, and then I'm going to tell you about seeing patterns in the CGMs that are really, really interesting. So we'll start with my particular information on me and what I learned. And so I find this is a great tool. I wish I had it in the office, you know, that with a 7-day diet diary, which has now been replaced by something like Chronometer or MyFitnessPal. Hopefully you're using one. But if patients could come in and say, here's everything I ate for the last week. And by the way, here's my story, my chief complaint, and here's my past blood work for the last couple of years. That's a great place to start. And that's pretty much how we did it. So now if I had on that 7-day diet diary, a CGM readout, that would really help a lot. You know, that would be one more level of seeing of whatever condition we're working on with the person. Is it the condition that I have to work at, or is it really dietarily oriented? You know, we can do 90% of the change of this person's health for the better strictly by diet or what else they need. And you know, I love tests, but I'm just saying on a 30,000 foot view, this is incredible. And it goes right along with food. So let's start with my numbers. Okay, so the first interesting comparison I put together, and I put this together as kind of a infograph for our Facebook group, is that we work out pretty much about 8:30 or 9 o'clock. So it's pretty much the same time, not every day of the week, but we do high intensity training twice a week. We'll do some cardiovascular. That means I'll do a harder set on the elliptical. And then on Sunday morning, we go in because nobody's in the extended workout room, and we'll do a kettlebell routine. And then the other days I can choose some light weights or something else. And we usually take off a day. That is, do not go to the gym one day a week, but it's important to us. Okay, so I get to overlay the time period. So you get to sort of see the effect on your blood sugar of the different types of exercise. So what I did was compare, so the kettlebell routine on Sunday versus cardio 45 minutes at a heart rate, BPM, of 130 to 140 beats per minute. So that's pretty high for a sustained period of 45 minutes. And I'm a 165-pound man, and I set that to level 20. So it's hard. And it's an up and down. I don't know what the pattern name is, but that's what I do. So I do that. And then twice a week, we do slow HIIT. And it's a definite, you know, Judy's there with the watch on the phone, in essence, a timer on the phone. And I have to go from 40 seconds to 130. And so most of my times are 40 to 60. Sometimes they're over a minute, but it's on the lower end versus the higher end of that range. And it's hard. And that's the way it's supposed to be. So let me compare. I'm looking at these three different days, and specifically the same time period. And so when I did the cardiovascular, which I would have thought it before doing the high intensity training aspect of life and really getting into it, that was a hard workout day. But I look at my blood glucose and it didn't spike it at all. It was like a walk in the park. Really, if I didn't know the time I was working out, you wouldn't know that I was working out by blood glucose alone. Whereas when I did the slow intensity training, which is what we do, 7 exercises, and total time for us is probably about 25 minutes. So you'll see probably about the time that I finish the set, and the first few just wipe me out. I do squats or leg presses and then deadlifts, that there's a huge spike in, I'd say a gradual spike, but it goes up very high. It goes up from about an average of 70 for me to well over 150. So we're looking at 160. And then it drops down finally about an hour, 45 minutes later. Let's see. I'm looking at looks like about quarter of 10. So from quarter of 9, workout, half hour, that's quarter after, that's about 9:30. So within 15 or 20 minutes of finishing the workout, my blood glucose drops down. So that's a pretty quick recovery. So how would you read that? You read that, and it's very interesting. You read that it is, because each exercise is over quickly, right? 40 seconds, done. And then I walk to the next one. I don't run. I walk to the next one and catch my breath if I need to. It's a staggered stress. So it's all about stress and cortisol pushing. I mean, that's the whole high intensity part. So it pushes my cortisol up each time higher and higher, but especially with things like the legs, which are the largest muscles in the body, and squats. If it's a compound exercise, you're really recruiting a lot of muscles. So you're doing a lot of quick, sudden stress. And that's the whole point of it. You're supposed to hit threshold. Threshold is cortisol. Threshold is adrenaline, otherwise epinephrine and norepinephrine, et cetera, et cetera. So they all kick in for a very brief period of time. And that drives up the blood sugar because my muscles need the glucose. Okay, so that's pretty much the setup for all this. But how I can read this now is because it was such a spike over a short period of time, which is really what the plan was, is that my growth hormone has been kicked up as well. So my growth hormone is going to be kicked up pretty much for the next 24 hours. So you can read the graph of looking at this and ask the question, was my high intensity training sufficient enough to kick in growth hormone? And though I don't have growth hormone measured here, it corresponds. They're correlated with each other. So that's interesting. So another person, and I haven't looked at Judy's in this regard, she doesn't like doing HIIT as much as I don't like doing HIIT. I find it necessary and I like the benefits. She hasn't seen as much benefits. So there's that. So that's extraordinary to me. It's being able to read, did you work out sufficiently well to reap the rewards? And part of the rewards were long-term sustained growth hormone. Okay, so now we looked at up the cardio, and so we knew we had a caloric burn. We did X amount of work over a certain period of time, and forgot what the reading was on the elliptical. I'm not quite sure if that's correct or not, but okay. But my blood sugar didn't change. That shows that I'm pretty fat adapted. I didn't get into the, for me, this is for me, it might not be for you, but since we've been doing this for a number of years, that it shows that I was fat adapted enough that I was still deriving my energy from ketones. So I'm in an ongoing state of ketosis. But when I did HIIT, that I exceeded that. I needed the sugar. And that's how it goes. I need the glucose in addition to the fat. And that's how it goes when you, for sprinters, fast moving sports, like parts of soccer, even though soccer is an endurance sport as well. MMA is all about fast pivoting and so on and so forth. So for sprinters and the need for quick responses, that's a blood glucose level. So you can train. This is now making my little lesson here bigger and applicable to a larger audience, is that you can train on keto, but you're going to have to compete in a glycemic diet because you're going to need that. You want to make that sugar as available as much as possible. So for those listening closely, somebody can say, well, would you then have, you know, higher carbs before your high intensity workout? No, I'm not that driven. You know, this kicked in my growth hormone and that's what I'm after. I'm getting muscle mass increase and that's one of the things I was after. And so it's working for me. I don't have any higher need to have this peak even higher. So now we go to the kettlebell routine. So the kettlebell routine is, that takes about a half hour workout. And it's about 7 exercises, and they're hard. So that's pretty much a high-intensity interval training, if you will. And that has a similar response to the high-intensity training, a little more graduated. And I'm looking at a graph in which I was just kind of recovering from being away from a week or two. I had caught some sort of respiratory cold, so I was just recovering from that. So it's a slightly muted peak there. But so you can see the degree of the intensity is the point from looking at this graph. Okay, so that's interesting. You have a nice comparison. Don't you wish everybody had this when they worked out? I mean, from high school kids on the football team or whatever the objective is. You could even wear this in the swimming pool. Though that would probably be for sprinters, they would get something out of it. So the other thing that I discovered, so this is still about Carl's recordings. You know, Judy did her 2 weeks before me, and I was listening to everything that she discovered. And I think there's a lot more to be revealed in looking at the graphs as opposed to any particular one point. So last Sunday, I had a glass of wine at about 4:15, 4:30. And so now I'm looking at my graph for that day. And I can see almost precisely at that point, 4:15, my blood glucose starts going down. Didn't go down much. I ride about at 70 as an average. So it started going down to the numbers here, 65, 63. And I didn't feel any difference. And here's an interesting thing. I'm going to talk about alcohol for a while. So beer is a little bit odd because that's a lot of carbs there. Wine, we try to get low-carb wine. So we'll say that's low alcohol and maybe a few carbs. But if you're fat adapted, alcohol in general stops your ability to produce glucose. So you can no longer produce glucose. And so your blood sugar is going to start to drop. Now, why is this interesting? Well, most bars and their happy hours are tailored around late afternoon, early evening. Here's our happy hour, usually 4 to 6. Not that I know that on a regular basis, but they time it for when most people do already have low blood sugar. And they want you to come in and order some drinks, which will further suppress your blood sugar. We're not talking about fat adapted person, blood sugar. And so what are you going to want to do? You're going to want to order food and most people order more drinks too, but you're then double feeding. You now have a doubly deep need to feed your sugar craving, if you will. You get your blood sugar back up. So now being fat adapted, and I had my wine, and so my blood sugar went down, and I generally wasn't aware that it went down that much. Went down about 10 points, and then we eat around 6, and this was we had some tenderloin, and I put some C8 oil on my meat with a little butter. Not a lot, just a little bit. So CA, remember C8 MCT oil, within 15 minutes, it produces ketones in your body. And so it produces ketones in your body. So now I can see what happens here is that my blood sugar didn't go down much further, went down a little bit. So I'm now getting numbers down in the 50s. I have 51, 50, I even had a 48. Can you imagine? I wasn't feeling many different. It was like, that's fine. But within 15 minutes of having that C8, I could tell my ketone levels went up. So I actually went and took my blood sugar level and I took my ketones levels because I wanted to verify, is my blood sugar really down in 48 because I had a glass of wine and I had some C8 on my meat? Well, the blood sugar reading was 56. So I'm going to say they were close enough. And my ketones were 5.6. So yow. So why was that? How did I get this large number of ketones? Okay, back to alcohol. Alcohol, there's this thing called oxidative priority. That is what your body burns for energy in its highest priority. So if you have alcohol, any type of alcohol, a spirit, liqueur, wine, less so beer, but alcohol is in there, it then says, this is our top priority. We stop making sugar, right? We stop making glucose. We stop consuming, and we stop making glucose. We stop consuming ketones. And so after the alcohol are your carbs, and after your carbs are your proteins, and after your alcohol are your ketones, and after your ketones is your carbs, and then your protein. So what is this showing me? This shows me that I took in, remember, so my blood sugar went down. I'm looking at this graph, so now I have a low blood sugar in the 50s. And now I took in some C8 MCT oil, and now I'm producing ketones. So my ketones went up so high in part because I wasn't burning ketones. It shut me off. Because I had alcohol in my bloodstream from the wine, my body says, okay, we're not, our top priority of consuming energy is alcohol. And then when the alcohol is done, we'll move on to the ketones, if and when they're around. And so I always have some ketones in my blood since I'm fat adapted. But at this point, I had a lot of ketones. So I was banking ketones, if you will. So now let's say I take these numbers of that moment of just about quarter after 6:30. So I just had my meat with my C8 on top of it. I had a little wine before that. So now there's a thing called glucose ketone index. If you remember me interviewing Thomas Siegfried, it's a big deal for cancer. You're trying to starve your cancer cells, the mitochondria of your cancer cells, from having any sources that they can convert into glucose. Okay? So you're blocking all those sources. At the same time, you're trying to beef up the ketones, so you're force feeding them ketones, and that's going to help the good cells stay alive and quickly kill the bad cells because they're very much glucose dependent. So that's where the GKI came from. So the GKI is a ratio of glucose to ketones. And the idea for cancer anyway is that you want to be at a ratio of one or less. So as an example, when I fasted a number of times, I kept spreadsheets on this and shared this with our Facebook group. So at the end of a nearly 7-day fast, I think it was day 6 and day 7, I finally got under a ratio of 1. So I got into the 0.5s and 0.4s. So it took 6 and 7 days for me to get to a GKI of under 1. So here I am after wine and a little C8, even though it was on top of my meat, I now have a GKI of 0.43. So I'm lower glucose and higher ketones in my blood than it took me 7 days of fasting to get to. So this is clearly a very medically therapeutic level of GKI to be at. High ketones, low blood sugar. So that's amazing. So within an hour, you can get to a therapeutic level. And I would caution, and this is new to me, that it could happen so quickly that you can get to such an important and decisive, you'll feel it, by the way. You'll feel you're on a ketone high. I don't really call it a high, but you get a sense that, I'm feeling a little different here. And it's not because of low blood sugar. That would be a whole different feeling. So I thought I'd share that with you, is that summary. You have alcohol, your blood sugar goes down a little bit because you're stopping producing glucose and consuming glucose. It's put on hold. It's all about consuming and getting rid of. You might want to think the body says, oh, alcohol is toxic, so we're going to get rid of it. However you want to get there, the top priority, the highest oxidative priority, is using your alcohol first, and then it will go on to ketones, then carbs, and the proteins. So alcohol drops the graph of my blood sugar. The ketones go up because I took C8 MCT oil on my meat, and that gave me a combination of blood sugar of 56, ketones of 5.6, interesting two numbers, and a GKI of 0.43, the equivalent of very therapeutic. I mean, that's a hard therapeutic thing to get to. So in talking to Thomas Siegfried, in talking about how hard is it to get to a GKI of one or less? He said, well, at least 3 days of fasting. And he's saying, and most people can't fast for 3 days. Here you go. So don't want to give you a hack, but these numbers are sufficient, and this is medically therapeutic. I don't think anybody with cancer would be suggesting to take alcohol, but this is how your body responds. So that was phenomenal. That's a phenomenal share to say, this is what's happened with a glass of wine and a little C8. Who knew? Never heard that before. The other thing I wanted to mention, you're probably not going to hear much about C8, even though there's a lot of products on Amazon for C8. You know how I feel about it. Ours is sustainably harvested, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's the purest out there. At least it's verified. But, we got into it, is it 4 years ago now? The whole idea of exogenous ketones, you know, people are taking exogenous ketones because they want to get their ketones up. Well, now I just verified, and I've done this before, verified it's very easy to get up with C8 MCT oil, at least our product, and you now can get into a therapeutic range of GKI. And you're not going to hear this. You're not going to hear any research really on MCT C8 oil outside of what Dr. Stephen Kanane has already done. And there's that interview I did with him as well. Because the money is behind exogenous ketones, and that's just the way it is. So FYI, I'm saying it's very effective is the point. It's also very cheap relative to exogenous ketones. Not everybody needs exogenous ketones. Not everybody needs C8. I encourage people to use C8 as a condiment. So I put it on my meat. I do put it with butter. That's the one dairy I have periodically on meat. It's a nice mix. So on with that. So now I'm going to go on to other people's graphs that they've sent in to me. And here is a really interesting story because of the context of these graphs. For one is, this initial graph comes from somebody that I've been working with and really trying to focus on taking his blood sugar level seriously. So I encouraged him to get this CGR, the CGM. And I don't know how seriously he takes it, though he likes Gizmo. So I think that's pretty much was the motivation. But when I see his blood sugar levels, they're always spiking. So here's a graph. Starts mid-morning. I mean, like 3 a.m. to about 9 p.m. is the graph that I'm looking at. And it's really a mountain range, you know, big peaks and troughs. And so this vacillation, this undulation, severe undulation, and I'll give you an example. The highest peak is about 225. So that's a blood sugar, equivalent blood sugar of 225, which is extremely diabetic. Diabetic is 126 or higher. And many diabetics a lot higher than that. And then that's followed by a fall that goes down to roughly 30, 35. And then this person no doubt has to have some more carbs and it goes charging up to nearly 200. And then it comes back down a little, you know, it's a little bit less than the peak before. And then it drops into a trough that's about, oh, now about 55. And so that's how that person's day goes, up and down. So here, let me give you, I know a lot about this person, so I can give you the context, but if I didn't know anything about this person, and this was their average day, you know, this is how they live, I would say this person, and I'll throw in an age, let's say there's someplace between 30 and 60, I would say this person's probably strongly pre-diabetic, if not diabetic, also probably has cardiovascular disease in some aspect, depending on age. If he's in his 40s, he's probably been working on this for a while. He probably has started to lose what he believes is mental clarity. So he has probably has mild cognitive impairment that shows up for him in various aspects. And so that's pretty much this person's life. And one can absolutely change this, but they have to want to absolutely change it. So we've talked about how to change this. Then basically it's, you know, the low carb, high fat diet, to be simple about it. Then you'd really track it. So that's amazing. It's a classic graph of somebody who is on a high carb. So the carbs, you know, knock the blood sugars out of the park, then they tank. And so this person goes from hyperglycemia to hypoglycemia and probably gets really tired, gets sleepy tired to the point that he either has to take some medication or he stuffs more carbs or whatever his favorite carbs are. So that's that one story. So that's a classic graph that you can say it's a, when I say diabetic, I would say it's an undiagnosed diabetic. It's a person who really has not either committed to the diagnosis of being diabetic and therefore, and let me qualify that further. Most diabetics that go for diabetic treatments don't have low carb, high fat diets. So this is clearly a pre-diabetic or diabetic person that has not implemented a low carb, high fat diet in any form. What's even more interesting now is his wife is schizophrenic bipolar. So why is that interesting? That's interesting because the patterns that he shared with me on her, that her blood sugar has gone down into the 30s on a regular basis. And so when you have that kind of severe hypoglycemia followed by hyperglycemia, is that your neurotransmitters are chaotic as a norm. You know, you're not calm, you're freaked out. You're excitatory, and then you're just tanking. You're almost passing out. Think of a drug addict, this image that is, and they're just about to nod off. That's exactly how it is with hyperglycemia, then hypoglycemia. They're just gonna nod off. And then gradually they wake from the hypoglycemia, and hypoglycemia is as dangerous as hyperglycemia. They're different. mortality is associated with both of them fairly highly. I don't know which one more. I'm guessing hyperglycemia. So that's the pattern. And so the fact that these ups and downs are out of control, and with, you know, I don't know enough about to know the effects of the medications on blood sugar. That would be, I don't think anybody does, by the way. So if you're to look at whether it's benzodiazepines, which are the Valium, or other bipolar or schizophrenic medications, you know, part of what they would be doing is stabilizing their blood sugar, and therefore that would stabilize a number of the neurotransmitters, increasing GABA, the calming one, or the balancing one. But the pattern gives away the personality. So I thought you'd preach that, and you know, I appreciate that. And I have like 4 days of these graphs of looking at, you know, how that happened. And it's extreme. And so I guess the point of all this is, you know, this whole path, at least the path that I'm on, started with our own health, taking care of our own health. And so mine was gut health, and Judy was brain health, because she was post meningioma and the 12-hour brain surgery operation. But this is now far reaching. So the theme for this particular podcast is that when you get control of your blood sugar, not in a way that, oh my gosh, I can't eat this, oh my gosh, I can't eat that, that your health is returned, and it's the easiest thing in the world to continue doing. But it takes a while to change the way you think, for one. That's the most difficult part. And then to change how you eat, so you get that leveled blood sugar. That's absolutely. So if you have a more level blood sugar, that means your insulin doesn't have to work so hard. And if your insulin doesn't have to work so hard, you don't need as much insulin to control your glucose levels. If you don't have the need to pump out to produce so much insulin, then your pancreas, your beta cells won't burn out. Your pancreas gets to relax somewhat. And also it speaks well of your glucagon. That doesn't have to be secreted also by your pancreas, because you're always just floating along there with hardly needing any guidance by either. And so that's what you're shooting for. So therefore, you have kind of a consistent ratios of neurotransmitters. GABA to glutamate, and so on and so forth, dopamine, serotonin. You have all that. It doesn't go extreme in one way or the other. The problems are when you hit these extreme levels that your neurotransmitters have to rush in to try to compensate for that. And then they rush in the opposite direction. So it's turning things off and turning things on. And that's when we're inclined to take drugs, or that's where our addictions start to happen. So I hope this has been fascinating to you. I figured I would take you a little into a detailed orientation. When you see it visually, it's amazing. So as much as, was it a year or two ago, when we're all about glucometers and then ketometers, and then the cost of a ketone strip was $10 and it came down to $1 due to Keto Mojo. You know, it's like, wow, you could get both of your, this is amazing. You know, for 14 days, which is what I call them, cartridges, you put it on the tricep of your left arm, you can do as many readings as you want. So you really get to know how you respond to exercise, how you respond to certain foods, how you respond to certain alcohols, if that's the case, if you're drinking, if you have alcohol. Really vital information. You also can infer, by the way, that person who had the peaks and the troughs, they have a high level of inflammation. I mean, that's an inflammatory pattern. Whereas the level one, a 70, is pretty much an uninflamed, it's a low or no inflammation pattern. So there's a lot of reasons. So if one was looking and had autoimmune, well, obviously you're trying to take the inflammation out of the body. This would be one way. If you looked at somebody's blood sugar level and said, whoa, you have, name an autoimmune, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, MS, you know, neurological autoimmunity or gut autoimmunity, and you had their pattern from their glucometer, you'd know exactly what to work on in terms of bringing their glucose levels to norm. It's a big, big help. Hope you see it that way. Okay, till next time, I hope you enjoyed this. Take care, all. Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp. I just wanted to encourage you to send in your questions to drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. Many of you have, and so what I've done with these questions that gotten back to most of the people I email, but some of the questions that were so good, And if they're overlapping to other questions, I would combine them and try to put that into the topic of a podcast, either via one of the micro topics that are covered in an interview. As you know, we cover a lot of topics in any given interview, or some of my own sort of reporting, if you will, on some of these issues. So please keep the questions coming. Feel free to send in an email, and I will get back to you. One thing I want to say, a number of questions have come in which I've given this answer and the email didn't work. So just make sure that you're receiving at the same email that you sent it in. And I think that might have been the difficulty. So I look forward to your questions. I just wanted to make sure that you knew that I'm hoping to answer your questions. And I think this world of keto is not just black and white. You know, it's nice that it's simple, but it's not simple for some. I'm really trying to, you know, go down, as anybody, any of you who have listened to all my podcasts, we started way back when, History of Evolution and Epilepsy and so on and so forth. You know, now we're seeing some tremendous overlap in various mental disorders, such as schizophrenia or neurological disorders that are not just epilepsy. And also, just for people in losing weight, it's sometimes pretty complicated for them to engage in keto, and so they need some help. And so that's the whole point of, at least that's what I think I'm doing, is exploring the world of why are there other factors. And so in exploring some of those other factors, we've covered addiction, we've covered hormones, we've covered nutritional deficiencies, we've covered certain metabolic lab results, and we'll go further. We'll even get to more on genome and aspects. So these are all just contributions that make for an obstacle for some people to engage easily in the ketogenic diet. This is my belief, and these are the things that I've discovered. And I think other people have discovered some of these things, but not ever put them together. So stay listening, send in your questions, and I will definitely get back to you.